For our first discourse of the new year, our brother Joshel has selected a subject, as you see on the screen, I think particularly appropriate for the start of a new year. His title is The End from the Beginning. The End from the Beginning. Brother Joe.
Good morning, brethren, and let me reiterate Brother Joe's greetings in the Lord for the new year to all of us, to all of you. And the new year, I think, conjures up certain thoughts. I guess for me, it's always a case of seeing the new year as a beginning and an end. You know, you were looking back, and we're looking forward, and which is in harmony with our title. And I think when we do that, we realize we're in the middle of something. We're in the middle of our own walk, but we're in the middle of a permission of evil. We're in the middle of God's work, and that work isn't done yet. And so, hence our title, and I thought an appropriate one for today. I think when I realize that we're in the middle of something big, God has permitted for us to have a sense of that, that we see work that's been done, we see the work that's yet to be done in the future, and it's unfolding right before our eyes. And I think God permits us to get a sense of that, not just in our own lives, but in everything. And then I realize how little control I have over the things that are going on. I have some control over what's going on in my life, but there's so much overruling that, well, it's kind of a feeling that I get looking at a night sky because, you know, you get to feeling very insignificant when you see all the things that are going on in the universe. You get a sense that there's so much motion and nothing is really out of control. And so I think you get a sense of the Creator in that way. Of course, He has capabilities way beyond ours. He says in Isaiah 55, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For ever as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain cometh down and the snow from heaven and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereunto I send it." This is why I have those feelings. We get a sense that God put things in motion, and He's overseeing the guidance of those things. He thought, He said, and the wheels were put in motion to bring everything into being. In the world, we title that, "Make it happen." In essence, that's what He did in the six creative days. This is sort of the concept that I have today of those things that are in motion, that God set in motion. That brings us to our Isaiah text in chapter 46, which reads, this is verses 9 and 10. "Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." We can apply that end from the beginning. I think I use it in all the time, or at least I think about it, and you could apply it any number of ways to anything that God put in motion. Anything that has a beginning and end, God knew about. in this case, specifically, it's saying things that are not yet done. So there are many things in God's world that are not yet done that he knows the beginning and the end of. But I'm going to apply this in a very specific sense today, in the sense of the seventh creative day. Because we're in the midst of it. It's not yet done. And I'm going to, in harmony with our text, show how God is declaring, has declared, and is declaring the end from the beginning of the seventh creative day. This will be sort of a brief snapshot. Not many details, but things from my mind, particular points about the seventh creative day that I'm just putting in my own words. A lot of it you will have already heard, but maybe not put into these specific phrases. But it's good to put things in our own way. So I hope this stimulates you in that sense. I'd like you to look at this line here. One of the ways that God has declared the end from the beginning of the seventh day is in time. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about time. Think of this as the seventh day of the creative week from Genesis 1, where he spells out the creative days 1 through 6, and then he gets to the seventh day, and he rests. Well, think of this line as a day on the calendar. It could be Saturday. It's the seventh day of the week. And I've been bold enough to already call it 7,000 years. And you will likely agree with that, but I'd like to first start out by stating a couple of reasons why I'm calling it 7,000 years. God has declared these things through his inspired prophets and apostles, but also through his designated messengers. And that messenger, the last messenger, has indicated very clearly, he was very specific on time. In the sixth volume, he says, "We do then find satisfactory evidence that one of these creative days was a period of 7,000 years." So I'm going to make that assumption, that it is 7,000 years, and that, and we'll go from there. But there's another text I'd like to look at, which answers the question. You know, this is an inference. He came to a conclusion that it was 7,000 years. Is there any text that states more clearly that the time period that we're in now, that I'm speaking on, is 7,000 years long? And I have come to the conclusion that there is. And that text is Genesis 3:15. And the discussion is between God and Cain. And Cain, you know, has just killed his brother. And in a previous study, I came to the conclusion that Cain symbolizes fallen man throughout the seventh creative day. And this text, though we don't have time to talk about its context, indicates that God's vengeance, that is his God's justice, divine justice, has meant an exemption, because no one can kill Cain now for murdering his brother, or else vengeance be on that person, indicating that divine justice, divine retribution, is actually on hold, and it gives the time period, sevenfold. And I interpret that as 7,000 years. And when I say permission of evil, I'm using that time period really as synonymous with the seventh creative day. I believe it. They are synonymous, and both of them are 7,000 years. And you may be thinking, well, wait a minute. Permission of evil is going to end at the kingdom. But will the world of mankind be subject to divine justice in the kingdom? No. They'll be protected by the mediator. It's not at the end, until the end of that period of time, that they will be subject again to divine justice. And so I think this supports the idea that we're dealing with a 7,000-year time period. Which brings us to how the seventh creative day, in one way, is different than all of the other days, because it was the introduction of sin that began the seventh creative day. And so this is a distinguishing feature, that the seventh day is about sin and getting rid of sin. It had never come into being before, but now, after man was created at the end of the sixth, now in the seventh, he sins, the seventh day begins. And now God is dealing, I should say, he's resting. But he's put in motion the wheels of permitting sin and then atoning for it and then training the world to choose right over wrong, in essence. So let's start talking about the beginning and the end, and as far as time. That seventh messenger also said, thus we have found clear and connected line of chronology from creation, that is Adam's creation, to the beginning of the Christian era, that is AD, the BC AD line, in all, a period of 4,128 years. So if we were to begin trying to define our day in time, we could start by a rough outline of putting that date, because we know that Adam was created 4,128 years before the Christian era. But I put question marks there because we've already outlined when the seventh day began. It was because of sin. And that date, 4128, is when Adam was created. It was not when sin entered. So we don't know yet. That doesn't define the seventh day, but what does? Brother Russell saw the harmony in what God was declaring. He saw it in time and in principle. In both the Old and New Testaments. And he saw how the Jubilee arrangement revealed so much about the past and the future. And he saw how types and shadows of the law were foreshadowing better things to come, more so than his predecessors. And it's from him that things have been declared to a great degree so that we can more and more make sense of what things, ancient things, from God's word can mean to us. And a key text involving that process of defining this day, New Testament text, is Acts 3:19-21. And I'm going to read just verses 20 and 21 to be as brief as possible. And he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heavens must receive until the times of restitution of all things. In this text is a combination of things by which the conclusion can be drawn regarding when and why for the seventh creative day. because he saw the types, he was able to see how this Jubilee system was going to be met in antitype, to become a reality. And in the second volume, he says, but this is not the type, but the reality. It was not a Jubilee year. And he's talking here about Leviticus 25, the Jubilee year. It was not a Jubilee year, but the antitypical 1,000 years of restitution of all things, which commenced October A.D. 1874. So just doing a little math there, if our time period is 7,000 years, and we have a 1,000-year time period at the end of which sin is going to be fully atoned for, and it began in 1874, we can draw the simple conclusion that 1,000 years from that period is the end of the creative day, which would be 2874. That part of it is a mathematical conclusion, but it's based on principle. So, following up with the mathematical conclusion then, if the whole year is 7,000 years long and it began in 2874, 4128 BC, we know is out because it's based on the creation of Adam. It's not based on sin. It's not based on how the Jubilee defined it. It's a separate picture. So we simply have to go back 7,000 years from 2874 and come to the year 4126. This then, in simple rough outline, is the beginning and the end of the seventh creative day. It's something somewhat significant, very significant, to have faith in. And it's a framework that we can build on. This is a creative day. Now, the previous days all had something in common. They had an evening and a morning. And then you remember God rested on the seventh day, and he doesn't declare that for the seventh, but he does it for every other day of the creative week, starting with the first here. And the evening and the morning were the first day. So, what is the deeper meaning to that? I'm not sure. If you have an idea, let me know. But it was recorded in the Bible because at that point in time, it was history. But right now, we're in the midst of the seventh day. It's not history yet. But God is doing the declaring about the seventh day. So we could surmise that God is in some way declaring an evening and a morning for the seventh day. And I think we can, and we can do it by the same way that we discovered the other dates. In essence, the law. Specifically, again, the Jubilee law. But it was meant, the law was meant to be a shadow. This is an important element for us to understand God's doings in regards to man. Israel represented mankind. God's dealings with Israel represent God's dealings with the entire world of mankind. The law was meant to be a process of dealing with them while they were yet sinners. But it was going to come to an end. And it was going to come to an end in the person of Jesus, because he came, think not that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill. In essence, he was going to fulfill all the aspects of the law and be the antitype. All the good things that were suggested in the law were going to come into reality through Jesus. And in the very next verse, he says something very important regarding our day. He says, till heaven and earth pass, not one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. And the meaning behind this, that word fulfilled, reveals a lot. In essence, it means that no type of the law will end without some sort of any type fulfillment superseding it at the same time, taking its place, without its any type having already begun. There's no gaps in God's process. This is what this one of the things this text is saying. So then, based upon all this, there was another conclusion drawn in the process to get to that 1874 date. One of the ways that that is derived is by looking at the type of that Jubilee arrangement, and it was concluded that 626 BC was the date that they last celebrated a Jubilee. In a typical sense, in that date, 626 BC. Again, I'm not going to give the particulars surrounding all that, but it's an important date. So based upon the fact of what Jesus' words were, no type of the law will end without its antitype having begun, we conclude that there is an antitype that began in 626 BC. In regarding to the Jubilee arrangement, in regarding to sin, in regarding to the law, something began there. So our creative day now has another important date, even though when it happened, no one knew it. No one could see this framework of this day back in 626 BC. It was kind of like now in January, we're after the winter equinox. The days are getting longer. But do we notice it day to day? No. It's a slow unfolding of light. So God declared to us when to start counting, because you remember they counted up their jubilees, their Sabbaths, and to get to their Jubilee year. And it does something interesting. It divides the seventh creative day right in the middle. It is exactly 3,500 years from the beginning, and it's exactly 35 years from the end, that date of 626 BC. So it's a nice faith-building confirmation that we're looking at an accurate picture of the seventh day in time. A little bit more on principle here in a minute. And it also adds a suggested answer to how God is declaring the evening from the morning of the seventh creative day. He said it in writing because when it was history. But history is still unfolding. But we have a means to see a distinction between the two halves of our day by which we might could say or surmise we are now in the morning of the day. And he's declaring it, the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done. So the time frame has been defined by the Jubilee. The Jubilee was part of the law. The law was because of sin. The seventh day is defined, is characterized by sin. Sin being permitted for a 7,000-year time frame. But it also defines the principle of what's going on. I'm going to make a summary of the Jubilee year, which was what they celebrated every 50 years. They counted and they celebrated, or they acknowledged it. In reality, they hardly celebrated it properly, but that's not the point. They had the opportunity to do so, and they recognized that year as the Jubilee year. A brief summary in my own words. The principle of that Jubilee year in the type was to give temporary liberty from the oppression due to sin. Because slaves were freed, whatever property that you had to sell to your neighbor because you couldn't afford it, you got it back. It was a new beginning. A new beginning. So in the antitype, the principle is similar. The Grand Jubilee, we call it, the 1,000 years, is to give permanent liberty from sin itself. Again, this is in my own words, but it's just a brief overview of the principle behind what's going on right now, is the counting up, the counting has been accomplished, and we're in the midst of dealing with the sin. But I've always had a problem in the sense of the Jubilee arrangement, because, you know, we talk about numbers, we talk about years, we talk about counting, we talk about law, we talk so many things that don't seem to have a direct connection with sin, because in my mind I kind of just push it off as a bunch of prescribe things, do this, don't do that, do this then, don't do it then, here's how to do it. What's that got to do with sin atonement? It's easy to lose sight of it. But I believe there's one text in my mind as a simple way to make this direct connection between the two. I mean, since this Jubilee is defining so much about our day, shouldn't there be something that gives a direct reference to sin? And that text is Leviticus 25:9. Let me talk a couple minutes about this. I'll read it first. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. In the Day of Atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. Now you could read this whole chapter 25, and if you're like me, I become a little bogged down because it prescribes so much and it gets into particulars on how the law was to be carried out. But let me just talk about this trumpet and when it was blown. This word trumpet is shofar, and you've all seen these. A shofar is a ram's horn. That's what it is. I mean, they could prescribe other descriptions of it, but it's the horn of a ram. Now, I'm going to be very simple here. And I like simplicity, especially in the Bible where things seem to be so bogged down with detail. If you just separate this description, a ram's horn, what are those words describing? A horn symbolizes power. Now look, it says the Day of Atonement. Where were they on the Day of Atonement? Well, the priests. They were in the tabernacle. Think of the tabernacle now, because we're in the Day of Atonement. These are synonymous in time. The Day of Atonement and the beginning of this year of Jubilee. Think of the things that go on in that tabernacle. Where are the horns? They're on the altar. There's four of them. It's universal power of that altar to cleanse for sin. And a ram, you remember, was used as a burnt offering. And when it was sacrificed on the altar after the bullock and the goat, it symbolized God's acceptance of that offering. So, simple conclusion that can be drawn from this, and I think it is meant, was that when that horn, when that trumpet was blown on the Day of Atonement, it proclaimed the power of the accepted sin offering. That's the power that went forth on this beginning of the year of Jubilee to make all of these things happen. You know, it's no wonder that in the typical days of Jubilee, years of Jubilee, nothing much happened because there was no power behind it. Because the blood of bulls and goats can't eradicate sin. But when the time comes when all of the blood is taken into the Most Holy, that altar, that symbolic altar, will have the power of the blood of Christ and his body. That will put the power and purpose into the 1,000-year Day of Atonement, the antitypical Grand Jubilee. I like when things can be simplified in my mind so that I can carry it with me without having to open up a book and sit down and think. This day that we're in, then there's a lot going on. But you know, God, it says in Genesis 2:3, and God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested. Sanctified has the thought of setting it apart for a higher work. And he rested, meaning that he's not the one directly doing the work. We know he handed that work over to his son. And there's going to come a time when that son hands the remainder of that creative work back over to the Father. And this is how we fit into this Grand Jubilee picture. 1 Corinthians 15:24, then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and all power. Think about the work that's to be done during that he that is being spoken of, that's going to deliver up the kingdom, is Christ in his body. And if you have prospects for being part of that body, think about what is actually the work that's going to be going on. It's going to be the completion of the creative day, the creative process, putting the crowning jewel on it, so to speak, in regards to all things in heaven and earth. But this Jubilee arrangement is primarily about things on the earth. It includes heavenly pictures, but the work to be done at that point is on the earth. So it is good for us to think about the process of that work that is yet to be done. Think of the final end result on mankind. Now, if in declaring the end from the beginning, is there a way to get a view of the end result of that work on mankind. And I think we can say, and we talk about routinely, about perfection of morally, physically. But I'm going to do something a little out of the ordinary here in regards to comparing the end from the beginning of this day in regards to the moral condition of man. Because we have a little snapshot in Genesis 3 regarding their moral condition. Because, you know, Adam and his wife were really representing the entire race at that point in their dealings with God. And so God, in his first conversations with them after the fall, he has interaction with them, and they say certain things, and he asks them certain things. And in particular, he asks them four questions. And in regards to their conversation back and forth, we can surmise their moral condition. And I just want to now just take a peek at those questions and look at them from the standpoint of how this indicates their moral condition, but also looking ahead and seeing how in each question there is a principle. Its application is necessary to have a relationship with God for success in the little season and beyond. Let's start off with the first question and a little bit of context. And Adam and his wife, this is Genesis 3, 8 and 9. I'm going to go through four questions, and you see the first question in red. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God. And the Lord God called unto Adam and said unto him, "Where are you?" Now, I have to tell you honestly, the things that I'm going to say are, subject to interpretation. And they are a bit speculative on my part. But I thought, you know, God doesn't ask questions like we ask questions. A lot of times we ask questions of people, and we don't expect an answer. But I would suspect more substance when God asks the question. And so that's why I think, or at least I'm surmising, that he asked these questions with the intention of getting an answer so that we can evaluate these questions and see how there is a moral substance or a principle behind it that we can gauge how our condition. I don't think I did it very well, but I'll give you what I have. Where are you? Well, any intelligent conversation with God would assume that God knows where I am. I mean, he's not like, even though it says he's hiding from God, it doesn't mean that God didn't know where he was. God's asking these questions to get us to think. Where are you? I believe the question becomes, where are you in your relationship to me? And it's for us to turn it around and say, where am I in relationship to God? This then opens up the possibility of taking from this the principles behind how is God viewing my behavior and my thoughts and my actions. And at this point, since this was right after he sinned and now he's hiding himself from God, he has to know that certain things are working on him. Now, I included this next text because it has the thought of God turning his face from mankind. And I think it applies in here somewhere, but I don't think this is the dominant thought, but I'm including it here. Habakkuk 1:13, speaking of God, thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Very true. But that would presume that God can't see him because God turned his back. But that's not what it says. It says Adam hid himself. They hid themselves from the presence, that is, the face of the Lord. So it's just the opposite. I knew that, you know, when we talk about, compare the garden with the kingdom, the word that comes up most often is obedience. We say they were disobedient. They're going to learn obedience in the kingdom. I totally agree. And so I thought somewhere in these four questions, it's going to reflect that principle. And it does, I think. But I think it doesn't in this question. I think the principle behind this is obedience, because where are you? Where am I in relationship to God? My relationship to God is dependent on obedience. It is obedience to his command to love. It is his command to all his moral guidelines. It is to be in conformity to a perfect man, since Jesus has purchased me. It is obedience to all of his word. And so I think the concept of obedience is implied in this question. I wish it was more clear, but let's go to the next question. This is in verses 10 and 11. This is Adam speaking. And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. And he said, who told thee that thou was naked? This one was the easiest one for me to answer. And I think it's a bit more clear. Who told you you were naked? Well, his conscience was working on him. You know, when we in the kingdom, Adam and Eve had a conscience. I didn't include the text. It's in Romans 2nd chapter, 14th verse, I believe. It talks about the law that is written in the heart. And that's what will be done by the mediator in the kingdom. They'll be writing the new law into the hearts of the people, and they will have a new conscience that conforms to those principles. God is simply saying, do it. It's interesting, you know, in verse 21, I believe, of this exchange, it is God then that gives them skins to wear because they felt naked and they clothed themselves with leaves. And then later on, he gives them skins, is being the first suggestion about the work of Christ and the fact of a blood offering. And so Christ is the one, the mediator, is going to be rewriting that conscience on mankind, conforming it. So the principle in this one, I believe, is simply listen to your conscience. That's why you have it. You're going to have a new conscience, the world will, at the end of that kingdom. And this third question is, hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat? Now, that on the surface seems like obedience, doesn't it? And yet, after I thought about this more, I thought, no. I think that you could think that this was strictly obedience, except that would leave out motive. And God would not leave out motive. You know, our own criminal justice system doesn't ignore motive in deciding a case. And the usual way we look at motive in regards to Adam's actions in this was he did it for his wife. She was the one who was beguiled. He was not beguiled by that. But when it came time to decide what he was going to do, he did it. We conclude that it was because of love for his wife. And in that, he erred. Because what he was in violation of was the great commandment, which Jesus summarizes in Matthew 22:37-39. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself is the second part, which is like it. He was in violation of this. The principle behind this is keeping your love for God first. Perfected man will have the ability to recognize and have a different love, two distinctive kinds of love, one for the Creator and one for everybody else. That's where Adam failed. He failed to clearly distinguish his love for God with love for his wife. And that was enough. And that is something the world will have to know in addition to their using their conscience and obedience. One more question that was asked in this exchange. And this one he asked unto the woman. And the Lord God said unto the woman, what is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, the serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. I wish this one was more clear, too. But I think the principle behind this is that being the one beguiled by Satan, Satan is the counterfeit God. He, at that point, had the ability to get an in on getting mankind on his side. In effect, he did. And has ever since, for all these thousands of years since then. He essentially has been the God of this world. So he's had some temporary success in that. That here, I believe, is the principle. And that is the supremacy of God. When she was beguiled, she recognized, in essence, another God. And this is something that God was very specific about with Israel. When he said in Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. He does not want any divisions in regard to his children. They don't want to... He doesn't want them to recognize any other father figure. He is the only one. Of course, it has a more practical application for the little season here, too, in the sense of when Satan is let loose. It's saying, don't be fooled again by this. That's a very practical thing to know for the world of mankind right before they get into the little season. But the more basic principle is the supremacy of God. The questions were from God. But the conclusions I've made are subject to interpretation. I would love to hear your interpretations also. Wish you the Lord's blessings for the new year as you consider the end from the beginning.